Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Ohio has Saturday Night Live on the brain. A new exhibit at Cleveland's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame got us thinking about the iconic show. The musical acts, the political humor, the silly sketches, the water cooler moments. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has recreated the famed Studio 8H stage, with more than 1,000 guest hosts have delivered monologues. And music legends from Paul McCartney to Elton John, from Beyoncé to Taylor Swift have performed. In this season, the 50th, musicians Chappell Roan, Billie Eilish, Lady Gaga, and Bad Bunny were among those to take the stage. We're going to start the show by getting a sneak peek at this new exhibit, SNL, Ladies and Gentlemen, 50 Years of Live Music. And joining us to talk about curating the exhibit is Amanda Pachenia, Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Welcome to All Sides, Amanda.
Thanks so much, Amy.
So this sounds like a really fun exhibit to put together, 50 years of Saturday Night Live musical acts. I'm sure it was a lot of work, too, but where did the idea come from?
You know, it's something that came from a conversation between Lorne Michaels himself, the creator of SNL, and the president of the board at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and just quickly sounded like a partnership that made sense. And we got rolling from there.
And I said it sounded like it would be fun, but hard work to put together. Was it fun and hard work?
You're right on with that. It was a labor of love. As a lifelong SNL nerd, it was a joy to work on and to see it come to fruition. And we're so excited that it's now open.
Now, the exhibit opened in late May, but you had your formal opening party on June 14th, and it was sold out, of course. Former SNL cast member Fred Armisen, a veteran of 11 seasons, was on hand. And you escorted him around the exhibit, and he explained some behind-the-scenes stories to you. What did he tell you that you didn't already know?
Well, it was just really great to get his insight, both into some of the early episodes that inspired him growing up as a kid. He remembers watching Devo. He remembers actually attending a broadcast of SNL when The Clash were the musical guest when he was in junior high, I think. And then just getting his thoughts about his last ever sketch as a cast member was really cool to hear.
Now, one of the items that you have, I'm definitely happy to hear you got it. It's the cowbell from the famous More Cowbell skit, where Will Ferrell and others are performing the Blue Oyster Cult's Don't Fear the Reaper. And before we get any further along this conversation, I wanted to hear some of that skit, which features Will Ferrell. Also, Christopher Walken is in it playing a recording producer. Let's listen.
Fellas, it was sounding great, but I could have used a little more cowbell. So, let's take it again. And Gene.
Yeah.
Really explore the studio space this time.
You got it, Bruce.
I mean, really.
Yeah.
Explore the space.
Okay.
I like what I'm hearing. Roll it.
One, two, three, four.
Well, you have more than just the cowbell in your exhibit, though. You also have the outfit Will Ferrell wore. And for those who don't remember, it's quite the tight outfit. Tell me about how did you get the cowbell and the outfit?
Yeah, we worked with NBC, with the team at SNL, to get the sketch-related artifacts. And, of course, More Cowbell was at the top of my list. It almost didn't make it to air. It was something that Will Ferrell had pitched several times. And then in dress rehearsal, he asked wardrobe to get him a tighter shirt. And the audience for the dress rehearsal went nuts. And it became the viral sketch that we know and love today.
Yeah, it's not just the cowbell that makes the sketch. It's Will Ferrell's shirt riding up while he's striking the cowbell and showing off his, you know, maybe not so fit tummy that also makes the sketch what it is, right?
100%. And I also learned while we were doing research on this that it was originally written as more woodblock I don't think that would have had the same impact
Oh,
as.
no, more woodblock doesn't sound right.
No.
So is this one, is the cowbell one of the big highlights people love to come see?
Definitely, but there are tons of great artifacts. There's about 70 pieces in the exhibit, featuring sketches from over the 50 years. So we've got Eddie Murphy as James Brown, from his Celebrity Hot Tub. We've got the Sweeney Sisters. We've got Bill Murray's Nick the Lounge Singer, all the way up through Wayne and Garth, and beyond.
Do you have a favorite besides the cowbell, I guess?
I think my favorite sketch-related piece in the exhibit is Kristen Wiig's Dunice character. That was a parody of the Lawrence Welk show, the variety show that featured wholesome family entertainment. And Dunice Maharel, part of a sister group, but she doesn't quite fit in. She's got kind of a large forehead. She's got a funny tooth, and she has most comically these little tiny hands. I was delighted that we were able to include that in the exhibit.
So you have the tiny hands.
We sure do.
All right. Well, I also wanted to play a clip from an appearance that happened in October 3rd, 1992. So during the video, so in the video, of you and Fred Armisen walking around the displays and talking about the SNL exhibit, you stop at one of the displays of one of the more controversial artists to appear on SNL. That's Sinead O'Connor. So this clip is from October 3rd, 1992, where she famously was protesting the Catholic Church while performing Bob Marley's War. So you'll hear her singing, and then she's going to be tearing up a photo of Pope Paul II.
We find it necessary. We know we will win. We have confidence in the victory of good over evil. Fight the real enemy.
Now, thousands lodged complaints. She was vilified for those comments, and that one performance affected the rest of her life and career. It came 9 years before the Pope acknowledged widespread sexual abuse within the clergy. In all of your research about SNL, how much differently do you think her performance would have played today than it did in 1992?
Hopefully, I think it would have played a lot differently. I think people would have seen it for the brave act that it was, that she was using her platform not to promote a new album, not to do any kind of self-promotion, but to speak up for something that she believed in, and unfortunately, something she had suffered herself, which was childhood abuse.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the new SNL exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland with Amanda Pachenia, Director of Curatorial Affairs. There's an interactive aspect to the exhibit. I mentioned in the introduction, you have the studio has been recreated. And did I read right? Can visitors like go up on the stage or kind of stand there?
Absolutely. You can practice your monologue so you're ready when you get to host SNL. So it's a great photo op on the reproduction of the home base stage at Studio 8H at NBC.
And what other interactive features does the exhibit have?
The whole space is really immersive. We worked with the team that actually builds the sets for SNL to create an environment that mirrors that studio, that iconic studio, as well as the exhibit sort of mirroring the flow of an episode of the show, starting with the cold open, going through the monologue, the sketches, and the good nights, as well as the bumper photos. But a really great interactive aspect of the exhibit is a series of touch screens where you can access and watch every single musical guest performance from the 50 years, including some that didn't make it to air. So that's really special. And I think people could spend a lot of time in there looking up their favorites.
And Akron-based group Devo is represented with one of their bright yellow jumpsuits. You also have other clothing. You have Billie Eilish, Blondie, Ringo Starr. Do you have any favorite pieces of clothing you were able to get?
You know, I do really love the outfit that Billie Eilish wore for her SNL hosting debut. It was a December episode, where they traditionally feature Christmas motifs. And she said she wanted to look like a Christmas present. So the outfit has these beautiful bows and beading and lace trim, and it's really spectacular.
And then you also have a ball cap that says Wayne's World on it, right? You have that. That's something people will recognize.
We do. We have both Wayne and Garth's, that's Mike Myers and Dana Carvey, their original Wayne and Garth costumes. But in addition to that, we have a Wayne's World baseball cap that was Alice Cooper's. Wayne's World being the most successful film spun off of SNL, and Alice Cooper made a cameo in that first film. And as one of our inductees, I thought it would be fun to feature that cap in the exhibit.
Now, did SNL just hold on to all this stuff and have it in their storage somewhere? It was just like waiting for an opportunity like this to be displayed, or did you have to go hunt down things?
As far as the pieces from the sketches, yes, NBC has held on to almost everything, and really had really everything on our wish list that we asked for. The artifacts related to the musical performances, we reached out to individual artists to collect those, and actually had a few pieces already in our permanent collection, which was lucky.
Oh, okay. Did you have any trouble getting anything? Like what was a great find for clothing wise that you had to get from someone else?
Charlotte Caffey of the Go-Go's offered us the dress that she wore on their performance, which took place right before or right after Beauty and the Beat came out. It's a beautiful vintage dress, I believe from the 40s, that she had cut. She'd altered it to make it a little more punk rock. So that was a really cool piece.
Now, the exhibit is open now. Does it have a closing date, or do you kind of just see how things go?
You know, we don't have a specific end date yet. It'll definitely be open through the end of the year and likely well into next year. So it's a perfect time, though, if you're taking a road trip, to come on down to Cleveland and see it and enjoy all that Cleveland has to offer.
Is it a part of the regular admission to Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or is it extra to see the exhibit?
Nope, it's included with your general admission. And just a note for any Cleveland residents that might be listening. Thanks to our VIP program with KeyBank, Cleveland residents get free admission all year to the Rock Hall.
Now, it's been open for a little while and you had your big grand opening. What has the response been like so far?
It's been super popular, which is so gratifying to see. It's really nice to walk in and see our fans, guests enjoying the exhibit.
I mean, I'm sure this happens all the time, not just for this exhibit, for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Do you have famous people who just show up because they want to see their stuff being displayed? And sometimes you know they're coming and sometimes you don't.
Absolutely. Some people just show up and surprise us. And then we do try to invite all the musicians appearing in the Cleveland area to come visit.
Have you had any surprise guests yet with the opening, or does that just occur maybe from now to the end of the year?
Not yet, but we're hoping that some of the SNL alum hear of Fred's experience enjoying the exhibit and come check it out.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time and thank you for telling me about the exhibit. We've been talking with Amanda Pichenya, Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how Saturday Night Live changed political comedy from how it portrayed presidents to other politicians. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Public Radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to wosu.org/protect.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Library, presenting the Columbus Book Festival with readings, signings, panel discussions, and workshops from over 200 authors, July 12th and 13th at the Main Library downtown. More at columbusbookfestival.org.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Saturday Night Live changed the way comedians depicted presidents. Original cast member Chevy Chase broke the mold, portraying Gerald Ford as a stumbling, bumbling leader. Over the decades, others exaggerated the mannerisms and speech patterns of every president since, for laughs. Late night hosts picked up the mantle, and then social media found its voice, amplifying political humor and satire in new and innovative ways. Poking fun at politicians is a time-honored tradition. But beyond the laughter, how does it shape how we view them and the national conversation? Professor Amy Becker teaches in the Communications and Media Department at Loyola University, Maryland in Baltimore. Her research focuses on political entertainment and comedy, public opinion, and political participation. She edited and contributed to the book Political Humor in a Changing Media Landscape, A New Generation of Research. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Becker.
Hi, great to be here.
So we started the show by talking about a new Saturday Night Live exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. And while that exhibit leans heavily into the musical aspect, we wanted to explore more about the political significance of Saturday Night Live. So I wanted to start by playing an audio clip. This is from back in 2008. Here we have Tina Fey appearing as former Alaska governor and vice presidential hopeful Sarah Palin. And she's joined by Amy Poehler as former senator and presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton.
But tonight we are crossing party lines to address the now very ugly role that sexism is playing in the campaign. An issue which I am frankly surprised to hear people suddenly care about. You know, Hillary and I don't agree on everything.
Anything. I believe that diplomacy should be the cornerstone of any foreign policy.
And I can see Russia from my house.
We all remember that line. How did a humorous sketch like that help shape viewers' opinions of both women?
Well, it's really interesting. That line in particular, I can see Russia from my house. Sarah Palin never actually said that. That was an SNL creation. But, you know, public opinion poll after opinion poll said that people actually believe she said it. You know, this was not the first skit that they did making fun of Palin. Tina Fey did a great skit with Amy Poehler playing Katie Couric and mocked that famous television interview where she did actually repeat a lot of the things that Palin actually said in the interview. But this Russia line is unique to SNL. But people, it was believable enough that people really thought that Palin had said this during the course of the campaign.
And in the sketch, they acknowledge the truth about sexism. You know, the show pokes fun at all politicians. Is there a different way that, you know, SNL pokes fun at males versus females?
I think historically, SNL is really focused on getting the impersonation or the impression right, the cadence, the physical gestures, the appearance. I do think that really, you know, the Palin impersonations are hard to compare to anything else, just because Tina Fey was such a natural fit and because Palin herself offered up so much raw material. I don't think there's necessarily a difference in the way that they treated the candidates by gender, but I think that they've always tried to give the most kind of honest and careful copy that they can of candidates running for office.
Now, can humor be helpful to a politician or a political candidate?
It can, and especially if a politician is willing to engage with the humor and tell a joke, right? People want to vote for someone that they can have a beer with. They want to vote for someone who can tell a joke and also can make a joke about themselves and engage in self-deprecating humor. I think that certainly, you know, if you think about SNL's impersonations of Donald Trump. So when we had Alec Baldwin playing Donald Trump, people actually preferred the Alec Baldwin version of Donald Trump and came to think of that as top of mind rather than the real Trump itself. So the portrayal actually helped to humanize Trump. But in general, the attention that you can get from Saturday Night Live is really kind of a generally a positive or a win because it gets people who are not necessarily paying attention to the day-to-day of politics, you know, watching a alternate version of the candidate.
Can it be harmful, though, too, to be made fun of basically on television?
I don't think, I think that sometimes the physical humor can be hurtful. So you opened talking about Chevy Chase playing Gerald Ford. Ford didn't love, you know, being made fun of for falling down, right? I think some of the more recent, you looked at this election cycle, Dana Carvey making fun of Joe Biden. I don't think that that helped Biden very much. But I think in general, if you are a public figure, you know, you have to be ready for this kind of scrutiny on comedy programs.
I wanted to play another clip from SNL. This one features Maya Rudolph as presidential candidate Kamala Harris. Maya Rudolph as Kamala Harris is sitting in front of a mirror, and in her reflection shows up the real Kamala Harris, who turns up to a huge sustained applause. And then this conversation ensues.
Kamala, take my Pamela. The American people want to stop the chaos
and end the dramala.
With a cool new stepmamala. Kick back in our pajamalas and watch a rom Kamala.
Like Legally Blondela.
And start decorating for Christmas. Fala la la la. Because what do we always say? Keep Kamala and carry on a la.
Now, we know, as we know, Kamala Harris did not win the presidency, but she's not the first politician to appear on the show. Gerald Ford is the only sitting president to appear on the show. George H.W. Bush appeared after he left office. Barack Obama appeared as a candidate. Sarah Palin was on. Hillary Clinton was on. So what does it mean for the real life politician to be able to make fun of themselves?
I think it wins them points with voters. I think if they seem down to earth and willing to be in on the joke, it's not just presidential candidates, right? There's some great examples of Chris Christie when he was governor of New Jersey would go on and he sat down with David Letterman and ate M&Ms and made fun of his weight, right? And so politicians' ability to make fun of themselves and to kind of be in on the joke makes them seem more like regular people and gives, you know, it doesn't necessarily translate into more votes, but it gives people a positive kind of impression of them as they get closer to election day. And, you know, McCain went on in 2008 just by prior to election day and was on Saturday Night Live. You see Harris doing the same thing. I think what's interesting about this Harris appearance is then it generated controversy because she got what they considered free airtime, right, on NBC, and then Trump had to get airtime during a football game. But this idea that, you know, you really are reaching a broad group of people when you appear on SNL, even though SNL has become more political, and I think you could argue maybe is reaching the middle of the country less than it used to, it still is a really wide platform that's different from a traditional news program.
Yeah, as a researcher, how do you measure the significance and influence of a show like SNL when it comes to looking at politics?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways people do it. There are a fair amount of people who've done survey research after SNL, and they track, you know, public opinion towards these candidates. And there was during the Palin election, there was kind of this bump in shifted opinion that people were a little less likely to indicate their willingness to vote for the Republican ticket if they had seen all of the different Faye impersonations of Palin. So it can kind of impact opinions. We measure it through survey research. We look at, you know, how much media content comes out after that Saturday Night Live broadcast. It's not just the broadcast itself, but it's the way it's talked about and circulated in the media narrative. And I've also done some work experimentally where some people will look at an SNL clip and some will maybe look at a straight news story and looking at the different effects on attitudes and opinions when you see the humor versus when you see something more straightforward. People like to laugh about politics, and especially in this contentious political environment that we're in, it's almost like comic relief. Right. And people kind of respond emotionally as well as attunately to the political humor that they see.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about SNL, political humor, and its impact on political participation with Professor Amy Becker from Loyola University, Maryland. Now, political humor can shape our attitudes about controversial topics, too. I mean, you kind of alluded to it just a minute ago. But like when you think about same-sex marriage or LGBTQ rights, even foreign policy, is there room for humor to shape even contentious issues?
Yeah. So I've done some work where, you know, issues that are kind of complicated, like we looked at net neutrality back in the day, or, you know, complicated science issues that comedy can influence opinions. It can make people think more seriously, for example, about climate change. And I think that there's actually been some work that looks at people learn more about like campaign finance reform when Stephen Colbert was in character doing his super PAC and all those other things than a straight news story. So comedy, because it lowers our defenses and because I think that in many ways comedians are kind of taking on the role of journalists or opinionated journalists, we are learning about issues from the way that those comedians explain things, even if, you know, there are jokes along the way, that people are, you know, working to understand the issue that's being talked and joked about. And so in that process of seeking out outside information to understand the joke, they're actually learning about these complicated issues. So I do think it can shape our opinions on issues on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that also makes me think of The Daily Show and also things that John Oliver does, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, because John Oliver's program in particular spends like a half an hour explaining a very complicated issue, but he also makes it funny.
Yeah, he does a great job. And I think his program is unique. It really is this kind of in-depth news magazine type program. And you can learn more about an issue from him or really see multiple sides of an issue. He's giving more attention to that issue. He's giving 20, 30 minutes, right? Where a news program is going to give just a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. So you're really getting this in-depth take once a week. His show, I think, is really important for, how much it influences the political conversation.
And I was just thinking about like stand-up comedians. I don't know if it's a I assume maybe it's a struggle for some of them when they want to be funny politically, but they go to a more conservative state. So if they come to like Ohio, a state that went for Trump in 2016 and 2024, can they make the same jokes that they would make in New York City?
I think you're probably getting a slightly different audience there for sure. Yeah. But I think also there are ways to joke about politics that don't have to be partisan. Right. There's a way to joke about an issue and, joke about a mistake that a politician makes or some sort of inconsistency that a lot of the political humor early on like late night television, a network late night TV was not necessarily taking a political point of view, but it was poking fun at the process or the people involved. I think political comedy has tended to become more, left versus right than it was. But everyone can laugh at somebody falling down or making a mistake or bumbling something, right? Regardless of their political preferences.
Have you followed how late night hosts are much more political now than they used to be? Because if you look back in the days of like Johnny Carson, he was not political, or the political jab at least was more gentle. But then now we have Stephen Colbert took a whole nother take with his political comedy. He took it in a different direction, the Colbert Report, when he adopted a different persona. We mentioned Jon Stewart is back. John Oliver's there. What about that transition? Is this just an adaptation of what people want to hear?
I think it's a little bit of, I definitely think that, when there was politics on Carson or even on Letterman or Leno, it was generally kind of playful, right? And not very pointed. I do think that, Stephen Colbert started off focusing more on entertainment when he moved over to CBS and he wasn't successful. And when he brought the politics back in, that's when the ratings went up. So I think that there is maybe perhaps more of an audience for pointed political criticism. But I also sometimes wonder about how broad of an audience they're really reaching anymore. And it's also, television is not a format that is really growing in a sense in terms of audience share, right? Young people are not watching late night comedy on television when they watch it. They're getting clips recycled on social media. So I think a little bit of it is kind of adapting to the format, but I do think the tone has become kind of more aggressive, more judgmental, and certainly more pointed politically than it was, a generation ago.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about young viewers because they're not camped out in front of a television after the late local news to watch a show. They're more likely to stream the show later or watch clips of it on YouTube or on social media. So how is their comedy consumption different and how are they going to be swayed by political humor differently than their parents?
I think, so it's technically the same content that's made for television. It's just repackaged in a different form, right? And so there is this need to have like more of a soundbite element to an opening monologue or, they're seeing the jokes that rise up as important the next day. So there is definitely an impact for them. But I think that we need to look at the late night comedy landscape. And this is something that I've been working on recently, the hosts of these programs are generally white males who are in their 50s and 60s, right? Mm-hmm. They're not exactly like young. And like young people who watch seem more like their parent, you know, they see their parents on television, right? Or people of the parents' age rather than someone that they can identify with. I do think that comedy has become much more personalized and emotional. And that, you know, we see a lot of comedians kind of breaking the fourth wall, talking directly to viewers. That honesty and that authenticity, I think, is helping to bring young people in. But it is also the repackaging of content that, you know, is first airing on television, but really is not being seen until social media.
Yeah, but there's a lot of social media influencers out there who probably wouldn't call themselves comedians, but they make funny skits or they go on rants and, you know, thousands of people watch it and subscribe to their channel. Is that the up-and-coming new age of comedy, is through social media influencers becoming back? They're becoming comedians in not the traditional way. They're not starting at Second City. Yeah.
Right. I think there is definitely, I mean, the influence of TikTok on politics and particularly for young people, you know, we're certainly there. And it's an important factor. Same thing with podcasts, you know, and other forms of, you know, not late night television media. I do think that these comedians still have kind of a credibility and a clout that means that their content gets reshared across multiple different types of media outlets. So I think that there is still this reliance, and maybe it's more traditional than it needs to be, but on these comedians to kind of talk about the political events of the day. And, you know, young people are still engaging with this type of political humor, but it's in addition to all the other things they're seeing online.
I just wanted to end with, you mentioned it a few minutes ago, that you co-authored a paper about the use of humor as a way to cultivate in science. And as we know, science and scientific research is under the microscope right now. And, you know, there's big cuts with DOGE. So I'm just curious how humor can be an avenue for effective communication about science and research.
So humor works for science communication when it's funny. So people, if they find the humor funny, they're more likely to share it. They're more likely to seek out other humorous scientific information and even factual scientific information online. So when the humor manages to talk about science in a funny and engaging way, it kind of works because it engages people, right? And they're more likely to look up that comedian or look up related content and share it with others. People also do really like science comedy that takes a particular point of view. So rather than presenting both sides of an issue, really going in all in on climate change and talking about, you know, how real it is and the threat, rather than, you know, are humans responsible, right? Which is kind of an outdated discussion. I think people appreciate the kind of like factual, opinionated, you know, one-sided take on in science humor. And then they are more likely to kind of share it and engage with others.
Well, that was Professor Amy Becker, who teaches in the Communication and Media Department at Loyola University, Maryland in Baltimore. Amy, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
On Point is continuing our week-long deep dive into the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. We'll look at proposed changes to food assistance that millions of Americans rely on.
What are you going to do when you go in the grocery store and there's not that food that you're used to getting? And if you're trying to eat healthy, the produce, the, you know, lean meats, the, all those things, and they're not available.
That's on the next On Point. Later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Asma Khalid. As Israel and Iran launch strikes at each other, we're taking a look back at America's role in the region. Support for the Shah, the hostage crisis, and the Reagan-era Iran-Contra scandal.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation into trading arms for hostages.
Next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, starting at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
With less content moderation, the Wild West of social media grows wilder. That's tomorrow on All Sides from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Help Me Grow Home Visiting. Trained professionals provide support and reliable information about pregnancy and child development to pregnant individuals and new parents, empowering families with tools and resources to help their baby to learn and grow. Learn more at helpmegrow.org.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We started the hour talking about a new Saturday Night Live exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. And that got us thinking about the show's political humor and political comedy in general, which draws heavily on the antics of our presidents and politicians. And with national and state politics becoming more red than blue under Donald Trump's two presidencies, how is that shaping the comedy landscape? Here to give us his take is Matt Sienkiewicz, a professor of communications and international studies at Boston College. He's also the co-author of the book That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. And he also edited the book Saturday Night Live and American TV. Welcome to All Sides, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So do you agree with the idea that most political comedy is left of center?
No, I don't think I do. I think that this is something that evolves over time. I think we had a period of time starting, around the turn of the millennium, where it was really easy to convince yourself that political comedy had a very specific bias. There's a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which being just the moment and the impact that things like The Daily Show had in the early 2000s as a sort of place of resistance to the Bush administration from liberal thinkers, and just sort of the way that the media industry worked at the time. There was a real desire and tendency to aim that sort of programming towards younger people who might skew a little bit more liberal. That was a moment. It was very famous and impactful. We had the famous Tina Fey, Sarah Palin moment on SNL. And it became very easy, I think, to think that that was a natural forever sort of arrangement. I think as we've watched things develop over the past few decades, we've seen that, political comedy can come in all sorts of varieties and stripes. It doesn't necessarily have to be one way or the other, outside of a given context. So in a moment, maybe, but I think in general, no, I wouldn't agree to that.
And in your book, you make the case that the right is slowly building a comedy industrial complex, adopting some of the strategies of comedians like Jon Stewart from The Daily Show and John Oliver. What strategies are they employing?
So, yeah, this was a book that we, me and my co-author Nick Mark from Colorado State, we wrote about 4 years ago now. What we were talking about then was something that was happening. And at this point, I would say it's essentially complete. The project has been achieved. And a lot of what we saw in the last presidential election sort of shows that off. So the major insight or the hopeful insight here is that, for a long time, the major comedy institutions tended to be these big, relatively powerful, relatively mainstream, a little bit center left things like Saturday Night Live, Comedy Central with The Daily Show, and so on. And if you wanted to get big in comedy, you had to go through those big institutions. Well, the new media revolution has totally blown up that idea. You don't need to have NBC behind you in order to build an audience. And in some ways, it can actually be a hindrance. So what we talk about in the book, and I think what we've seen over the past few years, is that smaller, lighter on their feet institutions with more targeted demographics have been able to build real audiences. And right-wing comedians have done a very effective job of taking, relatively small podcasts, YouTube shows, and kind of linking them together, supporting each other, and producing in total a really powerful array of programs. So the most famous sort of node here would probably be Joe Rogan, who he himself has a complicated politics, but he's very happy to bring on right-wing comedians grab his audience's attention. And then from that, we see people like Andrew Schultz, Tim Dillon, a range of people out there sort of putting together these small individual programs that in total are as powerful or more powerful than something like Saturday Night Live.
Would Joe Rogan consider himself a comedian, or is that just maybe one of the terms he might define himself as?
Well, I mean, if you want to be a media mogul, you have to be everything. But if you look at the Joe Rogan Experience podcast on iTunes, what's the category? It's comedy. You know, he is a stand-up comedian. Sure, he wants to do more than that. But if you look at his guests, a large chunk of them are self-described comedians. He came up as a comedian. He does do more than that, certainly. But I think that the heart of it, the thing that brings people to it first, is his sensibility, and a lot of that sensibility is a stand-up comedian sensibility.
Do you think that humor has political power? Can it help sway opinion of Republicans and Democrats at the federal level through with humor?
So, I mean, this is a complicated question. To a certain extent, culture is always going to kind of lag behind these things, right? I think it's going to reflect more so than create. And so that's one thing to consider, right? Is this a reflection of what's out there as opposed to something that's driving what's out there? On the other hand, I think we can see, you know, pretty decent evidence that there are real political and even electoral, you know, gains to be made through the use of comedy. One thing that's been really effective by this particular constellation of comedians like Rogan and Schultz and these people we've been discussing is that they are very targeted. And you can tell they're targeted because of the products that they advertise, right? These are things for mostly young people, mostly men, 18 to 34. Not that they don't go beyond that, they do, but that's sort of the heart of it. And this is a time when people make their political consciousness, when they, you know, sort of start thinking of the world in those terms, and also an age in which people like kind of do or don't vote, right? So the opportunity for mobilization in that demographic is disproportionately high. You know, you don't need to have as many listeners if every one of them is in a more, you know, sort of influenceable political stage. And we know this, right? The attempts of the Harris campaign to get onto the Joe Rogan podcast on terms that would work for them, and they couldn't pull it off, whereas Trump did, and Trump joined Theo Vaughn. His politics are kind of tricky too, but Andrew Schultz, Joe Rogan. I mean, I think it's very clear that there's something to be gained there politically.
Conservative media figures like Fox News's Greg Gutfeld, he continued to grow in popularity. Here he is on a recent show saying that the grown-ups are back in charge in Washington.
Suddenly, Washington has rediscovered what an actual boss looks like. And what happens when you have a great boss? The bossness trickles down. Now we finally got cabinet members who aren't just competent, they're kicking ass. Take Marco Rubio, whose transformation reminds us of when the Incredible Hulk gets angry or when Judge Jeanine loses a shoe. Here's Marco taking Chris Van Allen to the short bus.
I have to tell you directly and personally that I regret voting for you for Secretary of State.
Well, first of all, your regret for voting for me confirms I'm doing a good job.
Do you feel like he is? Is he trying to recreate the success of The Daily Show with the way he runs his show?
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an attempt to take the modes of comedy that were so successful in that period, where really this idea of politics and comedy being kind of locked together came in, right? This Daily Show period, really during the Bush administration. That is the strategy. He is, in some ways, trying to also bring back some of those pre-Daily Show ideas that we saw on late night shows. There are moments in which Gutfeld is trying to sort of bring in Johnny Carson in some way, and some sort of, you know, sort of like the guy who makes a joke about golf kind of thing. But then he's trying to slam into that sort of really direct partisan politics. You know, the opportunity, I mean, Fox is this very interesting history where they tried to do comedy for years and years, and they had some really famous, like very bad failures, shows that just could not work. They sort of have been working Greg Gutfeld and some other figures into their programming over the past couple of decades. And now they've got a show that, you know, it can compete or even beat things like Colbert. But it's important to note, it's more like those shows came down than Gutfeld is sort of at the same level as an old late night comedy show. But the mode is the same. You know, you can critique the writing if you don't like it. You can sort of say it's not for you. You can maybe argue against the quality if that's your position on it. But in terms of the mode, the style, the way it's trying to operate, it's really trying to bring the Daily Show idea from the right side and merge it into sort of the Tonight Show. And they're having success.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the changing media landscape of political humor with Boston College professor and author Matt Sinkowitz. Now, earlier you mentioned Andrew Schulz. He is an emerging voice. For those who might not be familiar with his work, can you tell me a little bit about him?
Sure. So, I mean, he is a figure in this new media world where he did not, he was not on Saturday Night Live. He was not a Daily Show correspondent. He didn't come up through the improv scene like some of sort of the figures you would think of in the historical days of comedy. He is more of a part of this sort of podcast YouTube world, and he's a stand-up comedian, where people who have a particular perspective and sort of a genius for marketing will put together their own programming and then interlock with others. So people like Joe Rogan, Theo Vaughn, these different figures. And so he's really just a comedian with a talk show, which is, on the one hand, nothing mm-hmm. brand new. On the other hand, it's self-marketed, it's on YouTube. And he has marked himself out first as being heterodox, sort of just having different opinions, but then over the past year and a half, 2 years, as being pretty explicitly partisan, or at least very interested in engaging with the Republican Party and Trump in particular. He had a very, I would say, very successful, well-known interview with President Trump on his show Flagrant, where Trump came on. We could talk a little bit about the content if you like, but the idea was to bring Trump into that space, give him a few opportunities to talk about politics, but mostly sort of just make Trump feel like another guest on one of these sort of like boys will be boys kind of, right-leaning talk shows. And it was, I think, very effective.
And to give people a sense of his voice, here's an audio clip from one of his earlier stand-up routines.
They always got these specials about the pyramids in Egypt. They're like, oh my God, the pyramids in Egypt. Who really built them? It wasn't the Egyptians. It wasn't the Jews. It was aliens. Aliens came down and they built these pyramids. This is how you know Mexicans are the best workers in history. There are also pyramids in Mexico. Nobody questions who built those.
We did our best to find, with any stand-up comedian, it's hard to find a public radio-friendly clip. but
no,
that was
for sure.
That's one we found. But there's many more clips of him out there. And then there's lots of clips out there of him with his 90-minute sit-down interview with President Trump. It was in October of 2024. And so it was before the election. But it was the month before he won a second term, and it racked up nearly 10 million views. Here he is asking Trump a question that is both personal and political.
So tell me this situation. Okay. Barron is 18. He's handsome. He's tall.
Yeah.
He's rich.
He's got the whole ball game.
He's
that kid.
Unleashed in New York City. That's... Are you sure you want to reverse Roe v. Wade now? I mean, maybe give him a few years,
Well, it's up to the states now.
That was an interesting interview. I mean, it was political, but it was comedy. I think that President Trump liked trying to be funny. Can you tell me about that and where that fits in this changing media landscape of political humor?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you picked the perfect clip. I think that is the moment that sort of best represents the move away from sort of just being political commentary and becoming kind of political advocacy through the role of comedy, right? So, let's think about that moment before the 2024 election. The Trump campaign has this very specific strategy of trying to recruit more young people, young men in particular, who may or may not vote or might be persuadable, right? And Trump had a general appeal for, think of his like UFC connections and WWE, all these sort of like things that are associated with young dudes, right? But he had one real vulnerability, which was that abortion extremism is not super popular amongst young men, right? It's I'm not a social scientist. I can't tell you exactly how it lays out, but that's not a strong, being super anti-abortion in an extreme way is not something that generally appeals to young men 18 to 34 for whatever reasons. So what does Schultz do in this interview? He gives him an opportunity to deal with that question, which is a vulnerability, as though it's a joke. Right, to turn it into a locker room talk, right? And attaboy, oh, Barron's going to be, having luck with the ladies in New York. And that becomes the discussion of abortion. And then he slides in this thing about states' rights and the sort of possibility of engaging with this question of, well, what would your actual approach to this be? Who would you nominate for judges and so on? Kind of gets pushed to the side The person who might be worried about that as a younger man, I don't like that. You know what? He made a joke about it. It sort of like neutralizes it and puts it to the side. And then they get on to things where he's got more strength and connection. And that's a moment where I would say we're looking at basically open advocacy, which, you know, is Schultz's right. I mean, he certainly can advocate for a candidate that he wants to, but he's using, you know, the comedy in that very specific pointed way. And the Trump administration or the Trump campaign at that point was looking at these young male comedians as the opportunity to do that, right? That the older guy standing up on stage is going to have trouble getting that across. Andrew Schultz can get him to that point to neutralize that issue and maybe even turn into something that is attractive to young men.
The idea of right-wing comedy versus left-wing comedy, sometimes the lines are blurred. You know, it's hard not to find some of Trump's outrageous statements funny. It's also hard not to laugh and also cringe at the same time when Dana Carvey is playing a stumbling President Biden and he runs into a wall on Saturday Night Live. So how do you feel like very mainstream things like Saturday Night Live handle both sides of it? Do they equally make fun of the right and the left?
I mean, I think that that varies season to season, and it varies sort of on what the cultural appetite is. You know, my gloss on that would be that, you know, there was a period of time over the past 10, 15 years in which everything in American culture got so polarized along political lines that it seemed virtually impossible for even a mainstream institution not to lean into a political side of the aisle. It just seemed that it couldn't be done. And I think SNL probably sort of went into that and said, okay, you know, that audience of all different types of people is just not gettable anymore. There's too many options out there. We can't try to both sides things. We're going to have to try to lay our cards out. And I think that they, you know, pretty clearly announced themselves as at least vis-a-vis Trump being on the other side. I think that you still have some of that, but I do think there's a realization that comedy is maybe not sustainable at the level of SNL if it can't have a somewhat broader appeal, or more than anything, if people who just aren't obsessed with politics can't enjoy the show, right? And I think that's probably the biggest thing for something like SNL. They can't avoid politics. Obviously, it's a topical show. At the same time, if the show is only for people who are devoted to politics and you're getting totally partisan all the time, is that enough for NBC to justify its enormous budget? I mean, SNL's budget is crazy. Yeah. You know, they produce all these new sets, everything every week. So I think we're seeing a sort of, I wouldn't necessarily call it attack to the middle politically, but attacked away from overt politicization at all levels of the show. They want to expand that audience and at least open up the number of people who might be comfortable and excited to watch it.
We've been listening to Matt Sinkowitz, professor of communications and international studies at Boston College, also the co-author of the book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. Matt, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
The fact is, America is now engaged in a...
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.